This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Shuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the international community should pressure Iran to get the Houthi to agree to some peaceful understanding in Yemen.
That's Saudi analyst Jamal Khashoggi. Details coming up.
Also, violence in central Mali has sent about 3,000 people fleeing for their lives to Burkina Faso, and Taiwan's new president makes her first trip to Africa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story, the UN Refugee Agency reports a spike in intercommunal violence in central Mali has sent about 3,000 people fleeing for their lives to Burkina Faso over the past few weeks. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency warns intercommunal violence is on the rise between the Dogon and Payil communities in the Koro area of central Mali. Since February, it says dozens of people have been killed and homes and other property destroyed as clashes between the two groups have increased. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says his agency fears more people will flee as extremist and intercommunal violence escalates.
The new arrivals in Burkina Faso include 2,000 Malian citizens as well as 1,000 Burkinabe who have been living in Mali for many years. With many afraid to travel by road for fear of kidnappings and murder, they arrive via unofficial border crossings on foot or in light vehicles. The new displacement adds to the challenges faced by people of the region.
Before this latest influx, Burkina Faso had been hosting some 24,000 Malian refugees since the start of Mali's conflict in 2012. These new arrivals are putting more pressure on the humanitarian needs and the ability of aid agencies to meet them. Spindler says food is in short supply and health facilities are overstretched. He says most of the new arrivals are living with friends or relatives in hard-to-reach areas. He says UNHCR is urging them to move to a refugee camp further away from the border where they could be registered. He says they would have access to basic social services there and be better protected from rising banditry and violence in areas hosting Malian refugees. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Taiwan's new president makes her first trip to Africa this week to visit one of the island's two remaining allies on the continent, Swaziland. Support for Taiwan has diminished in Africa over the past decade as billions of dollars in Chinese investment has flowed into the region. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The tiny African kingdom of Swaziland says it's standing firm by an increasingly unpopular ally in Africa, the small self-governing island of Taiwan. China claims Taiwan as its own and has, in recent years, ramped up pressure on African nations to drop their ties with Taiwan, as Taiwan has moved towards seeking formal independence from China. Jennifer Naves, Swaziland's Undersecretary for International Cooperation in the Foreign Ministry, spoke to VOA on Tuesday as she headed to the airport to receive President Tsai Ing-wen for a four-day visit to the small, landlocked kingdom. Taiwan, she said, has long funded a range of agricultural, industrial, and vocational programs in Swaziland.
For 50 years, our relationship has been characterized by principled engagement, a deep sense of mutual respect, fraternity, and loyalty. And these are all attributes that the successive heads of state of our kingdom value above cosmetic and popular global politics.
Swaziland, which has some 1.3 million people, is Africa's only absolute monarchy. The nation is technically a democracy, but political parties are banned, and King Mswati III is the top executive who rules for life. Kubus van Staden, a senior researcher on China-Africa issues at the South African Institute of International Affairs, says China has, in recent years, successfully pressured some half-dozen African nations to drop Taiwan. Most recently, Sao Tome and Principe cut ties in 2016. As the only two holdouts in Africa, he says, Swaziland and Burkina Faso face immense pressure as well.
Swaziland is small, But at the same time, China has worked hard to make to set up relationships with other small and also very poor countries. So, for example, you know, Sao Tome and Principe are also very small and economically also very weak. But, you know, kind of China put in a lot of work too to make friends with them. So I think, you know, there's a whole lot of political symbolism involved.
Taiwan, too, he says, needs every relationship it can get.
From Taiwan's side, I think it is, you know, a lot of it has to do with symbolism of, you know, especially for someone like Tsai Ing-wen, who, you know, whose party is a pro-independence party. There is a lot of political symbolism riding on this idea that Taiwan isn't just ignored and isolated in the world, that it has, and you know, that it functions as an actual country. And so for that, you know, having diplomatic relationships is crucial.
Tsai's visit to Swaziland ends Friday. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Yemen's Houthi militia, which is supported by Iran and Lebanon's Hezbollah, has vowed to step up its missile and rocket attacks on neighboring Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are leading a coalition of Arab and Gulf states trying to push the Houthis out of the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Houthi militiamen chant slogans against the United States and Israel earlier this month as they fire ballistic missiles into Saudi Arabia. Sunday, at the 29th annual Arab summit in Dahran, Saudi King Salman accused Iran of supplying the Houthis with missiles. He calls the Houthis terrorists backed by Iran. He welcomes the United Nations' condemnation of the Houthis for firing 119 missiles at Saudi cities, including Mecca. Former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr tells VOA he is not sure if the missiles came from Iran, but argues the Houthis are using them because the Saudi-led coalition has inflicted serious damage with its airstrikes on Yemen. He says the Saudis have never treated Yemen as an independent country, but as a protectorate. He insists the Saudis are conducting a savage war in Yemen and justifying it by claiming Iran is supporting and selling arms to the Houthis. University of Paris professor Khatar Abu Diab tells VOA the Houthis recently vowed to fire a missile a day into Saudi Arabia. He says many countries criticize the Saudi-led coalition for its airstrikes on Yemen or the humanitarian crisis, but few complain about the Houthis taking children hostage or firing missiles at Saudi Arabia. He says the Houthis also pose a regional threat for attacking vessels in world shipping lanes. Saudi analyst Jamal Khashoggi argues the Houthis have significant support in Yemen and Riyadh should seek a pluralistic regime.
They are a force to reckon with. They are popular in Yemen. Their problem that they want to control Yemen, at least the Yemen Republic before 1992, not the South. And this is not a working recipe. They cannot control all of Yemen. They cannot bring Yemen back to pre-republic time, the monarchy time. Yemen is a republic.
Khashoggi thinks the international community needs to pressure Iran.
The international community should pressure Iran to get the Houthi to agree to some peaceful understanding in Yemen. But in the same time, Saudi Arabia also needs to believe truly in democracy for Yemen. I think the Saudis are also reluctant, as much as the Iranians, about democracy. Each country wants to impose its blueprint in Yemen.
But Bani Sadr thinks it might be difficult to get Iranian leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei to change his behavior because his regime relies on outside conflicts to survive. He says Khamenei recently insisted Iran was living the best moments of its history because it is not just a regional but a world power. This, Bonnie Sutter stresses, is how the regime profits from war to impose itself domestically. Khatar Abu Diab thinks Iran is playing a dangerous game that could backfire. He says Saudi Arabia is the target of Houthi missiles, but it also has missiles that can reach Tehran and could set off a tit-for-tat war, igniting a very dangerous regional conflict. Khashoggi doubts there will be outright war because both sides know the high costs of a direct confrontation. But Bonnie Sutter is less certain. Very often we think threats are merely verbal, he says, and then suddenly war breaks out, as we saw in 1980 when Saddam Hussein attacked Iran. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The UN Refugee Agency reports that Horn of Africa asylum seekers and migrants arriving in Yemen are being detained under horrific conditions by different armed groups and criminals profiting from the situation. Lisa Schlein has the story from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The agency says it is following the cases of some 100 Somali and Ethiopian migrants who arrived in Yemen recently and are being detained near the capital, Aden. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says the new arrivals may have broken immigration laws, which is not an unusual or worrisome development. What is of concern, he says, are the harsh conditions under which the refugees and migrants in detention are living.
Reports of abuse inside detention facilities are numerous, with some new arrivals being subject to physical and sexual violence. Survivors have described the UNHCR being shot at, regular beatings, rapes of adults and children, humiliations including forced nudity, being forced to witness summary executions, and denial of food.
Spindler says there are an unknown number of other makeshift prisons in Yemen where people are kept in captivity, subject to brutality, and held either for ransom or extortion. In the past, he says, those who arrived in Yemen would go to refugee camps where they would be screened and processed. But with the collapse of law and order in the country, he says the situation has become more dangerous. He says many people, including armed groups, smugglers, and criminals, are taking advantage of the refugees and migrants in terrible ways. Since February, Spindler says, the UNHCR has made numerous interventions on behalf of those held in detention. He tells VOA these efforts are consistently frustrated because no one knows who is in command in this war-torn country.
It's very chaotic and very difficult to really know who is really in control. As you know, the country is divided, there are rival administrations. There is not a clear line of responsibility that we can directly go and appeal to the authorities. And we receive reports of people being held by smugglers, and we have no access to these places.
Yemen's economy is in tatters and its health system in a state of collapse after 3 years of unabated war. The UNHCR warns people not to undertake the perilous journey to Yemen. It says Somalis fleeing in search of asylum and Ethiopians seeking a better life risk drowning in the Gulf of Aden, while those who survive face abuse and exploitation. Still, the agency says about 87,000 people arrived in Yemen last year, and people are arriving at a similar rate this year as last. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Nigerians go to the polls next year in presidential elections. One group that's fighting to make their voices heard are 17 million Nigerians who live outside the country. The diaspora rights movement is fighting for the rights of expats to vote. The group, formed in 2003, has branches in the United Kingdom, Africa, U.S., Scandinavia, and Asia. It's behind a campaign for an amendment to Nigeria's constitution that would allow those who live abroad to vote. Lawa Ayula is the chairman of the group of Nigerians living in Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Finland. Reporter Mike Mbonye asked him to elaborate on the goals of the group.
This group is agitating for not just people residing in the diaspora. We basically categorize them into four groups. One, the workers. Two, the internally displaced people. And three, certain professionals, such as the military personnel, public officials or diplomats, and their families. And the fourth group are the citizens living temporarily or permanently outside Nigeria.
When did the agitation for diaspora voting commence? Why do they deserve to vote? Who are you lobbying in Nigeria or abroad for the right to vote?
The agitation started more than a decade ago, and there's been progress about the diaspora commission, the diaspora rights. However, the voting rights has been excluded. One of the key promises during the election was a diaspora vote coming on board in 2019. However, we're still waiting for the ruling party to live by their words. However, we have some legislators on board with us, such as Honorable Gbajabi Amila, who is also a diasporan. And he has given his own perspective on the way to go about it, which made us to know emphatically that it's about constitutional amendment. And we know that the Senate committee, a chairperson on diaspora matters and NGOs, non-governmental organization, in the name of Nadia Boros, she has been very, very active and very involved in ensuring that the diaspora vote comes to pass.
Do you have an idea why successive governments in Nigeria have not approved diaspora voting? What reasons do they give? Is it expense, or is it likely that diaspora voters would vote against the sitting government? Does the diaspora favor one party over another?
We're basically talking about why the successive government in Nigeria have not approved the diaspora voting. It tends to be an issue of a constitutional amendment. And I tend to believe that maybe then we have not done enough. We have not done enough. Enough agitation have not been made to make sure that we are on spot. And we tend to realize that we are included in the entire system. And we tend to realize that this issue is an issue of constitutional amendment.
Do you think diaspora voting will make the difference in any Nigerian election? Do you see examples of where diaspora voters may have changed the outcome of a vote?
I personally believe, and the group specifically believe, that the diaspora vote will make a huge difference in any election in Nigeria. In the sense that we are very exposed. We are living in an advanced country where things are working, and good governance and democracy are in top gear. And we tend to think of replication of such in our own land. Thereby, if we are involved in this election, if we are given the right to vote, it means that there will be more scrutiny in and the caliber and the type of the people that will be in governance. Indirectly or directly, is going to have a direct impact on how the country is governed.
Lawal Ayula is chairman of the group in the Scandinavian countries of Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Finland.
In South Sudan, a group of former child soldiers are heading home, but once the celebrations end, a long journey to healing begins. They will need assistance on multiple levels. The families and communities they are returning to may still be the same, but these young people have no doubt changed thanks to what they've seen and experienced. From Johannesburg, Nadia Sami has the story.
The children's release from armed groups is being welcomed, but the road ahead will not be easy. They've been exposed to extraordinary violence, and some have perpetrated atrocities themselves at the behest of their captors. Dr. Shahida Omar explains the likely state of mind of a child who's been rescued from a militant group. She's a clinical psychologist at the Teddy Bear Clinic in Johannesburg.
The concern is that these children are actually no longer children. They've been brainwashed, indoctrinated to fulfill the roles and responsibilities that would be normally assigned to an adult. So we're looking at pseudo-adults. children who are now functioning and development is still that of a child, but the responsibilities that they've had to deliver has been that of an adult. So it is actually quite confusing for these children that have fulfilled these responsibilities for a number of years.
One of the difficulties with reintegration is that the children and their communities may now have totally different ideas of what's considered to be normal behavior. The road ahead will be long and complex. In the case of the children being released in South Sudan, UNICEF will assist by giving the families 3 months' worth of food aid, as well as psychological support and access to educational facilities. But Dr. Omar explains, to reintegrate successfully, they'll need much greater support.
Assistance would be on different levels. I think, firstly, they would require the debriefing, the de-rolling is very important, that they will no longer be fulfilling those responsibilities. And they would require long-term therapeutic intervention, working on the ground in terms of their needs, in terms of where they at, where they've been, and where they are going to.
The children are not the only ones who will need counseling along the way. Their relatives and community members will also have to be sensitized about the children's ordeal.
One would also have to work with the family that the children would be returning to and being reintegrated into. So I think looking at that reunification process is also critical.
In the coming weeks and months, the former child soldiers will have to relearn what it means to be children. Having put down their arms, they'll once again pick up books, pens, and soccer balls. They'll also have to walk the road of trusting those around them as they rebuild crucial relationships. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Hayes Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Linor Moudou, host of Health Chat. April is Autism Month in the United States, and next week on Health Chat, I will discuss autism, a range of conditions characterized by challenges with social skills, repetitive behaviors, and nonverbal communication, among other things. Our guest is Scott Badesh, President and CEO of the Autism Society of America. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says he will seek his party's presidential ticket to contest elections in February 2019, ending months of speculation about his future. The future of 75-year-old Muhammadu Buhari on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.